Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about podcast while driving. Going to talk about Tidbinbilla. I find it rather hard to pronounce. It's a place we went to in Canberra, which is the capital territory of Australia. Something about the size of Luxembourg. It's not the size of Holland or Belgium. It's like a sort of a good old sizable fraction. I think just waving to a neighbour as this is obviously a podcast while driving. You'll hear some car noises. Oh shit, sorry, I shouldn't have said that. Something dropped on the floor, but it was okay. It wasn't a laptop or anything like that. Just wave to you people. I'm driving off to Springwood Foundation Day to meet the mayor. Now, what I want to talk about is Tidbinbilla and Canberra. So Canberra is the capital territory of Australia. It's up in the sort of high country, based on the idea that people are more cool-headed and more efficient in cooler climates. So that was one of the ideas. The major selling point of Canberra was its absolutely chilly climate. Now, it's compared to, I don't know, anywhere in Europe, it's much hotter, but it's definitely can cool down in winter. It's a mountain range, and it's the north of it's the capital, and going further and further south, one gets into a sort of extended country ACT, and one of the ranges around there is the Brindabellas and Tidbinbilla, down to the south of Canberra. So you work your way through the southern, suburbs of Canberra, Woden, that type of stuff, from northern Canberra. So you come in from Sydney's to the north. There's a lake there, Lake Burley Griffin. Across the lake is the Parliament House. You're facing south, and it sort of means that when you're looking at it, the Parliament House is set with a Southern Cross behind it, the sort of the state symbol and the big flag there. And Tidbinbilla is a range of these sort of granite outcrops, mountains, rather nice looking mountains and sort of fairly spectacular hilltops, because rather than just a smooth hilltop, there's a little granite outcrop. And that area, sort of idyllic sort of country, and Tidbinbilla, most people will know, is got the, from 1973, the Deep Space Station, NASA's Deep Space Station, a set of iconic but definitely 1970s style white radio dishes pointing skyward. And I'm not going to really talk about this. This is sort of a loop you can do through Tidbinbilla. And coming out of the area, you can see these dishes and a turn off sign to the space base. And the road has not been cut at all. It's not been leveled at all, and it sort of goes up and over the hills, and it's absolutely idyllic. It's sort of like driving across a duna. You know, there's a road on a duna. It sort of hugs the surface of it. So imagine you had a duna with a road pattern on it, and it curls up, and the road's like that. And it's a really beautiful thing. And you go in there, and of course, they say switch off your mobile phones. I don't think anyone really does. And you go in there, and there's a space suit. A bit about NASA and NASA's in the space shuttle, and a few sort of retro things, and a bit of a biz about the space industry. So it's sort of worth, half an hour going around having a look. There's sort of no real information about what it is doing and its impact and its importance. They don't have, say, a globe, spinning globe, showing that when North America is facing away from the deep space probe, the Australian probe, the spray Australian dish starts to point at it. If that makes sense. So the Earth is spinning. They haven't done on that basic point. So Didymobila is actually a little nature reserve, and it's got a route, and inside the nature reserve is a fortified sanctuary. That is, they have baited and kept out foxes and rabbits and all the other invasive species, and surviving in there is pretty much the last refuge of some pretty iconic Australian animals, at least one very iconic one, which is the brush tail wallaby. I'll just give a little bit of a talk about that. So this wallaby has the most luxuriant fur. It looks like a grund parody of wallaby, like a super thick, got thick eyelashes, very thick tail, wooly, because it's so cold up in that area, and it's a rock wallaby, so the rock wallabies are sort of the acrobats of the marsupial bouncing world. I'll just go through and see, this is all happening here. It's sort of fairly busy up the mountains here, going across here, and I've got to get to Springwood on time. What happens is that there's a limited number, about 36, not under 100 of these animals, and they're all microchipped, and you know, the last 36 of them. There's a few other, small pockets of them. Genetic diversity is a real problem with them, obviously, so few, because they weren't just hunted as sort of like without mercy to make up these beautiful wallaby hats. This would be rather interesting. I'm going to stop now because I've got to go into the car park here and get moving. I'll be back really soon. So we've talked about Didymobila, a mountainous range, and in it is a fortified sanctuary with several layers of fences. I'll stop and talk about that a bit later on. Okay, I've completed that errand, but unfortunately I remembered I forgot to get some more of my heart medication. Damn, I'll have to come back somewhere. That will make me so unbelievably unpopular. But we're talking about Didymobila and the rock wallaby. And now, can I say, I was prepared to find out information, but I really wasn't prepared for some of the information I was going to find out about this rock wallaby. So what they have in the centre is a vet care station. Sort of people's sort of concept is that you have a sanctuary, you have the animals here, and you have veterinary care, much like those African survey things. It's sort of, if you just have the animals by itself, it's got a sort of a human activity aspect to it, the volunteers, etc. And the vets carry out health checks on the animals as they need, well, do. Some of the things they do is they check for mites. There's obviously, I don't know if you know about kangaroos, they're full of mites. They're sort of, well, like most animals, rabbits or anything like that, out in the wild, if they're not pets, they've absolutely got this huge mite insect load on them. And when they get sick, the sort of first sign of sickness is sort of mite loads. One of the things with animals is they can be sick for a long time, but their behaviour stays the same. They don't have a sickness behaviour. Sickness behaviour is really a sort of a social animal can look sick. You can see, obviously, an animal which, your dog or something, which looks sick. But if it's in pain, they don't tend to give much. So they have, I can understand this health trick, and they capture them, and we were there just for the rare event of the health check. So what it's done is basically in a surgery, I'm going to have to stop here because I'm going to have to really watch this traffic. There's this traffic is beaming past and not a single sort of hint of a gap that I could possibly get in. Oh, well, there is. So I have to carry it through. So I'm just going to be quiet here. There's a long gap. It's Springwood Foundation Day, and so every man and his dog is going up the mountains. Okay. So Springwood's the next suburb up, and here's a gap for me there. What happens is this sort of building with a sort of glass half, and they've got a speaker and the microphone, and the vet's there with the attendants, and they've got this rock wallaby which they've sedated, and then they put it under a quick acting anaesthetic. Now here's some information for free that the start of the information coming through. The kangaroos and marsupials can only breathe through their nose. They can't breathe through their mouth. What? Well, it's true, and so therefore, to put a breathing mask, you just only have to get it over their nostrils, because they can't not breathe through them. You know, what? And so they've got a little breathing mask on it. And then we start with the teeth. Obviously, check. And the teeth. Well, look, the teeth are basically the two front teeth. First, the mouth of a marsupial doesn't open fully. It can't. A marsupial can't actually get out and bite you because its jaw doesn't extend open. What? This is, yeah, its front teeth. It's got two front long teeth, unlike a sort of like a rodent's teeth, but unlike that, not flat. They're scissors, basically scissors for cutting grass. The most amazing process. So these long triangular front teeth, and when I say long, they're incredibly long. Sort of, I just can't describe how long. About possibly 3 centimeters long, an inch long, but diagonally, and they go into a point. Yeah, the two triangular teeth come down, not separate. They come into a single point, and the bottom. Then they have about 5 cutting teeth at the underneath. Then the gap, and then little molars at the back. And the molars are there, but the jaws can never open fully. They're just so. There's no way that a kangaroo would be able to ever speak. And go that if you're lucky. Basically, there's koalas got, well, they sound like wild pigs, honestly, and if you are out in the Australian bush and you haven't heard a koala before, and you suddenly are in this copse of trees, put up tents, and the koalas come in at night, and you go, I've spent a few terrified nights thinking I'm being surrounded by these wild pigs, and of course it's these koalas. Obviously during mating season, it's a real racket. You know, people go open the windows and say, for God's sake, shut up, going him. So that's one aspect. Now moving down, you've got these beautiful black padded paws. They look just like, it looks as though it's been bought in a gift shop. A big eyelashes, almost like comic book eyelashes. It really does look as though it's a grund doll. Now the interesting thing is the pouch. I think this is a male, but the female also has a pouch. And this is some of this, we may as well get into the genetics of it, which is the real killer for me. So the pouches, there is a pouch bone. I didn't know that. There's a bone which supports the pouch. Sort of makes sense. You can imagine, oh, my pouch has got a bit saggy, or so that's why it's there. So there is such a thing as a pouch bone, sort of go figure. And then besides the pouch bone, we have the complexity here that some of the tackle, as we call it in Australia, but the wedding tackle, we would say, like in mammals. So there's mammals. There's placentals. Where are the placentals? Because that this is basically a parasitic growth from the embryo. It springs out and puts a parasitic plug on the mother and feeds off the mother's blood supply. Pretty amazing that doesn't happen with the marsupials. Marsupials are transitioning in the transition point. Well, their scrotum is above their penis. Now, the depending on what they look like, the kangaroo penises are pretty amazing things to see. They sort of snake, almost prehensile snaky penises, but there's a bit more I didn't know. They're a forked penis. What? A forked penis? They go into not one but two ends, because the female has three vaginas. Don't quite understand. Obviously, it's almost like an arms race coming up here. Now, what really shocked me, I'll have to do a little stop. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to stop here so I can really focus on this next section here, which is parking at Springwood at Foundation Day, which is, I think, probably the most insane thing I've ever done for years. So thanks a lot for listening. Okay, I'm just continuing now after that about an hour chatting to them there about plans for the Blue Mountains and science, all very positive. Now, going back to the genitals of marsupials, and the fundamental is that the balls or scrotum is north or closer to your mouth than the actual penis. The penis is down in the grey kangaroo. It's an S-shaped penis. In the wallaby, it's sort of a thick penis with two prongs on it. And firstly, we're going to give a story about there are marsupials which provide, in general, they provide milk and sustenance for the young, as opposed to the other groups of animals, which are reptiles, amphibians, and birds. And amphibians and reptiles are from pre-dinosaur times. Birds are essentially dinosaurs, and highly evolved dinosaurs are the humans. The marsupials. Mammals were furry things, pre-dinosaurs. They originally would have come from some sort of reptile or something like that. And in marsupials, you've got placentals, which throw off due to hijacking a virus, which basically it's sort of on the edge of cancer. If I can say, is a placenta is a controlled cancer, a controlled beneficial cancer that your mum suffers. You've got placentals, you've got marsupials, which are your pouched animals, then they live in a pouch. And then you've got the monotremes, two examples of monotremes, which is the platypus and the echidna, which is the Australian super hedgehog. Sort of a hedgehog with real attitude is our echidna. Now, you've got to understand that the echidna and the platypus actually have bird beaks. There you go. And like birds, they lay eggs, and I can't quite remember what it is, but they're called monotremes because they've only got one hole. Monotreme means hole, one hole. So you automatically think, well, they've got one hole. Marsupials are different. They've got, they're obviously not monotremes. And so the platypus and the echidna actually lay an animal which feeds their young milk, but also lays eggs. And there was such upset at this that the Europeans, who said, you know, this is a direct threat to the Bible, went to Australia and said, find me a platypus laying an egg. And of course, it meant this wholesale explosion of cannon fodder. You know, that would just blasted out of every pond, everywhere throughout Australia, on behest of these scientists, creationist scientists, trying to find a platypus egg. So I don't quite understand the full story of it. But getting back to it, so we've got the male stuff, which, you know, you're a wallaby with a forked penis, and there are three vaginas, and that sort of makes sense because you can fertilize multiple eggs, and they can stay on the in the cooker, suspended, fertilized, ready to go when the first one comes out. So what happens is that you can have explosive growth of marsupials, and dare I say, I have seen it—the most amazing stuff. Where that they can multiply as if, like, yeah, rabbits are okay, but rabbits have multiple litters; they produce one at a time. But what happens is, rather than multiple litters, they've gone for a serial approach. So you got rabbits with, you know, multiple litters. What they've got, because the development to get up there, they've got a multiple approach. So they've said, okay, rather than multiple embryos, you can have positive. I must admit, I've never seen a twin. I just don't think that such a thing exists in a marsupial. But so you've got two, and then what happens is that they plug up to stop sperm going in and disturbing a little baby. Oh, what's this going on? And then the little grub, basically, it's like a little worm that develops into a worm, sightless worm, which crawls out of the body, out of the vagina area, up through the fur and into the pouch. And it does that in pretty much, I was heard, a minute, two or three minutes. So that's getting a wriggle on, so to speak. Now the important thing here is that three vaginas, I can possibly get my mind around that, because the three vaginas are not that important. They're not going to be wombs. So you can, if you're not going for wombs, you can multiply up. So you can sort of see marsupials have gone through a different strategy. Right, this is to allow, if you've got a method of having children, you need a method which can, and your environment's changing, you need to accelerate your population up, or your niche will be taken by someone else. So there's competitive warfare. So you can see that marsupials have gone down this particular path, whereas where we have, you know, the savannas of Africa, you've got the herds and basically the growth of intelligence. And, you know, it's a lot more complicated rather than getting up. It's sort of more isolated there. So I'm just coming home on it. Now, the big surprise, obviously, is that if you've got three groups, the placentals, mammals, and monotremes, and the monotremes are ones with one hole, do marsupials have a vagina? And the answer is not a vagina. Well, they do have a vagina. Do they have the sort of the, a second opening for it? And the answer is no. They also have got a cloaca, like a bird. Like a bird does not have a separate little opening. And the story behind that is that why would you? Because it doesn't. You haven't had sort of one of the things that you had to have developed with a womb. You can't, you've got to get a separate hole happening to get the baby out. You can't poo and get a full-sized baby out of the same hole. It's pretty an amazing sort of story. So the marsupials only have one hole. They've only got a bottom of whatever it is. And for me, that was just blowing me away. And it sort of really taught me that how much you take some information and then you build up around it. Then you wind up passing it on. You just assume that that's there. So obviously there's no real need for a vagina because there's not a big kangaroo popping out of it. It's stuff like this. And of course, I suppose another thing, so your wombats, everything, only have one hole. And these, I suppose the thylacines, the thing is where you have that big, I suppose there must be a way that's organized, that there's not necessarily like you've got a path, but it's poo or reproductive. It's sort of not all mixed up together, because, you know, you have a bit of a time. If you're one of those little micro Joeys going out to the path, and oh my God, I've got to wait till my mum goes to the toilet first. There must be some method of doing it. And it sort of also makes sense that, like some of the poos, of marsupials are highly shaped. Now, just as a side, and you can pick it out like anything. So, spot a wombat poo. Well, the entire idea is that a wombat poo is got full of, it's like a wombat air freshener. And, they have to poo, and they will put it on top of a rock, their poo. On top of, you've got a pointy rock, and there will be a little poo sitting on top of the rock. Obviously, you're aware of this if you are trying to rock hop through a stream or something. There will be a little poo doing it. And of course, these little poos, if you're trying to balance a poo on a rock, making a sphere poo is just the wrong thing to do. It is just insanely unstable. So the wombats have developed an ability to create cubic poo. So what happens, it goes out of the body, out of one anus, which is relatively spherical. The other one, before they poo it out, shapes their poo into a nice cube. And this is a pretty amazing, amazing thing. And you can sort of see how this happens. So the marsupials are pretty amazing animals, and of course they're not that bright. We'll talk about like most grazing animals, they have to not burn up too much energy eating. Like if they're really smart, then you've got to be okay, well now you have to eat 50% more grass. It's sort of like this, and that grass is not a very intellectually stimulating thing to eat. And you've got to chew it, and you've also got to digest it. So you've got all these things coming along. Now, the other interesting thing is that the flora inside marsupials do not have archaea. Their flora digestive system does not produce methane. That is, that your kangaroos and wallabies and koalas, as they're munching away, don't produce the same greenhouse gas load as cows do. And this is a fascinating thing. And also, their milk is really interesting. It doesn't have lactose. It's got another chemical. So you could have kangaroo milk if you're lactose intolerant, kangaroo milk. And also, they've got a huge range of antibodies. Now, the thing for kangaroos is that their jaw fuses on, actually locks onto the nipple permanently, coming through. Now, the thing is that their jaw locks onto the nipple, and it means that as the kangaroo bounces off, you can't just pull it off. It's not suction power. It's actually locked onto the nipple there. And of course, kangaroos have four nipples inside, and they produce up to three different types of milk. I think it's starter milk, which is cholesterol, embryo milk for the developing joey, and then it's called walking. There's also the walking joey. So a joey will keep with its mum, hop around a bit. They may jump in for a little bit of a ride and comfort, but they spend most of their time out of the pouch, and they come over just for a feed and stick their head in. And so those different nipples produce different grades of milk. So that's a real powerful thing. Now this person's just waiting for me to cross the road home. I will be told off. I just can't fathom how I'm going to be told off, but I will be told off. So that's the story of marsupials, and I don't feel particularly proud as an Australian, but you do get, obviously, the whole place is crawling with marsupials, so you tend to find out about it, and you tend to say, oh, well, that's, you know, things reach plague proportions really quickly. Now, what's happened in New Zealand, which didn't have any marsupials, it broke off separately. Someone had a bright idea of bringing a possum. Now, a possum with no predators and the ability to have explosive population growth means that the place is plagued with possums. Like, it's like Possum City over there. You just can't blast enough of them away. And of course, we probably need thylacine or some other marsupial tiger to just go through and munch it out to get going. So that's the story of Tiddenbilla. I've still got to talk a bit about the culture there, so I might do that after. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.